Medic one inbound to your facility. Emergency traffic on a 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. Following multiple gunshot wounds. CPR in progress. Patient intubation. IO in place. Stay with you in 5 minutes.
Welcome to the EMS Handoff, your source for all things EMS. And now, let's welcome to the show your hosts, Bradley Dean, Eric McCullough, and David Blevins.
Hello, and welcome to the EMS Handoff podcast. This is Bradley Dean, and on behalf of my co-hosts who are not able to join me this week because they're on vacation, David Blevins and Eric McCullough, we are your source for all things EMS. Today, we welcome each of you to the podcast, and we're going to have an interesting discussion on something that we all have learned about with resuscitation and medications. Eric is our social media web development and overall educator, and David kind of takes care of everything, edits, and makes sure that everything gets posted on our platforms. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our podcast partner, the Journal of Emergency Medical Services. They've been a tremendous partner to the EMS Handoff podcast. While the EMS Handoff serves as your source for all things EMS in the podcast verse, GEMS has been an industry leader in the profession for many years. Go by their website and support their efforts to keep the industry informed, and to also check out our fellow GEMS podcast host. GEMS has expanded their podcast platform recently as well, trying to make sure that they get all of the stuff out there. GEMS has added distribution of the EMS Handoff and others through Spotify. So go to Spotify and look for EMS Today by GEMS, and then look for the EMS Handoff on Spotify. Additionally, I'd like to point you over to YouTube, where you can find all of our podcasts as well. And we'd like to introduce you to the EMS Handoff merchandise line with our apparel partner, Pursuit Outfitters. The EMS Handoff podcast has partnered with Pursuit Outfitters to offer a line of comfortable and stylish EMS handoff gear with t-shirts, long sleeve t-shirts, and hoodies for you. We would love to see your picture on our social media and your EMS Handoff merchandise. Visit www.pursuitoutfitters.com/EMS Handoff to find the color of your choice. So as promised, tonight's going to be a little bit interesting to make sure that we cover some educational things while everybody else is on vacation. Wanted to take a minute and talk to you a little bit about something we all have learned with resuscitation. And we'll call this, "And the Dead Shall Rise Again," an epitale. So the contents discussed here are my reviews of relevant research in resuscitation and are not recommendations for changes to your local protocols, policies, or procedures. Any changes to local policies, protocols, or procedures should be done in conjunction with consultation and approval of your medical director. The content is provided for expanding your knowledge as you explore the research and evidence presented, should you wish to conduct your own reading of the research and the relevant article. References are provided for you. Just because we talk about something and we talk about research, that doesn't mean we need to rush out and change practice. We all know that research shows that patients that are prone are less likely to aspirate, but it doesn't mean that we need to dig the backboards out of our dumpsters and then go out here and strap our patients to them and turn them upside down. So let's talk a little bit about epinephrine. What do we know about this amazing drug? Because it remains one of the most common ALS interventions and likely increases the rate of ROSC for patients after cardiac arrest. Its effects on long-term outcomes, though, is really far less uncertain. Epinephrine may be reasonable in cardiac arrest. However, the literature behind its use is controversial based on initial studies in the 1960s. Epinephrine can improve ROSC, but patients who receive an epi demonstrate decreased survival to discharge and poor neurological outcomes. Well, where did all this come from? So if we go back to the 1960s, published in JAMA in 1968, it showed that a small number of patients receiving epi were awake at 24 hours, and a good number of those patients still died after 24 hours. So further studies will be necessary to clarify the optimal combination of drugs to enhance the effectiveness of artificial ventilation of the lungs, external cardiac massage, and external electrical countershock in resuscitation from ventricular fibrillation. So what's really happening inside this miracle vial? Well, we take this miracle vial and we give it to our patients. Is there some magic potion that allows us to magically bring back the dead? Well, let's look a little bit at the research. Well, in 1990, published in JAMA, we know that the coronary perfusion pressures were increased when epinephrine was given. And we know that the coronary perfusion pressures have to go up in order for the patient to perfuse the heart and hopefully return to some type of a normal rhythm that produces the pulse. So let's talk a little bit about the epinephrine pharmacodynamics. So it has alpha adrenergic and beta adrenergic properties. We know that it increases diastolic pressure and increases that coronary blood flow, increases that coronary perfusion pressure, but it also causes platelet activity and impairs microvascular blood flow with the alpha adrenergic effects. The beta adrenergic effects, we know that it increases cardiac contractility, allowing the heart to pump better, but it also increases myocardial oxygen demand and increases the likelihood of arrhythmias, which is one of the things we really want to try to avoid. So in all the literature and the research and the stuff that we've looked at, early epi is beneficial for return of spontaneous circulation. We know it's not great for neural outcomes. We know that high-dose epi does not increase survival. I, of course, remember 1 milligram, 3 milligram, and 5 milligram doses of epi when we did the escalating doses. And more epi is associated with worse outcome. So what do we really know? So out of all the studies that have been done, observational studies involving more than 500,000 patients have reported higher rates of return of spontaneous circulation, but worse neurologic outcomes in patients who were treated with epinephrine. The interpretation of these findings has been limited by conflicting results and the influence of unmeasured confounders. So there are so many unanswered questions about epi. The question is, how often should we give it? Right now, everybody says the standard is get it on board as soon as possible within the first few minutes of a cardiac arrest, and then every 3 to 5 minutes, because we know what the half-life is. Well, how much should we give? Well, current standard practice is 1 milligram of epinephrine. What rhythm? If you look at the American Heart Association guidelines, the rhythms that are there says, you know, for VFib, VTAC, asystole. So we're giving it pretty much with everything. And then the question is by what route? Well, the route that we're looking at most of the time is IV, but the question is, should it be IV or IO? And research actually suggests that IV versus IO, one is not necessarily better than the other. So in 2012, there was a study that came out entitled The Pre-Hospital Epinephrine Use and Survival Among Patients with Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. This was a prospective, non-randomized, observational analysis of data from about 417,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests that occurred between 2005 and 2008 in Japan. All these patients were 18 years of age or older, and they had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest before arrival of EMS, and they were treated and were transported to the hospital. So with this design and what we're looking at, the question is what really happened? Well, with the patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in Japan, the use of pre-hospital epinephrine was significantly associated with increased chance of return of spontaneous circulation, but decreased chance of survival and good functional outcomes 1 month after the event. So questioning the use of epinephrine to treat cardiac arrest was published in 2012 as an editorial by Calloway. And basically what Callaway said, you know, we really should look at epinephrine a little bit deeper, and we should study it more, and that should consist of a rigorously conducted and adequately powered clinical trial comparing epinephrine with a placebo. Well, physicians and other practitioners involved in cardiac resuscitation must consider carefully whether continued use of epinephrine is justified. So let's look at epinephrine and the dosing period and survival after in-hospital cardiac arrest. So this was done in about 2014, and it was a retrospective review of 20,000 in-hospital cardiac arrest patients. And what they did was they took the time between first epi and endpoint of resuscitation divided by the total dose of epi. And what they looked at was the longer dosing intervals improved survival. And this was true for both shockable and non-shockable rhythms. So the odds ratio for survival with a 95% confidence says that longer epping dosing intervals correlated with increased survival, not your standard 3 to 5 minutes, which was interesting. So do we really need to take this and compare it to a placebo? We probably did. And some of you have probably heard of this trial called a randomized trial of epinephrine and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, also known as the Paramedic 2 trial. So they took, and it was randomized, it was double-blinded, and it involved 8,014 patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in the United Kingdom. There were paramedics at 5 National Health Service ambulance services that administered either parenteral epi or saline along with standard care. The primary outcome was the rate of survival at 30 days. Secondary outcomes included the rate of survival to a hospital discharge with a favorable neurologic outcome, as indicated by a score of 3 or less on the modified Rankin scale, which goes from 0 no symptoms to 6 death. At 30 days, 130 patients, which was 3.2% in the epi group, and 94, 2.4% in the placebo group were alive. Unadjusted odds ratio for survival, 1.39 with a 95% confidence interval. So there was no evidence of a significant difference in the proportion of patients who survived to a hospital discharge with a favorable neurologic outcome. So basically, what does that mean? Well, adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, the use of epinephrine resulted in a significantly higher rate of 30-day survival than the use of a placebo. But there was no significant between group difference in the rate of favorable neurologic outcome because more survivors had severe neurologic impairment. In other words, more survivors had severe neurologic impairment in the epinephrine group and did not survive to be able to resume some sort of a normal life. So knowing that epi is a vasoconstrictor, is that really so surprising? So what was causing their issue? Why were these patients having poor neurologic outcomes? So if we think about what happens with epi, and we have vasoconstriction, and we have poor peripheral blood flow, we know we're going to have poor cerebral blood flow. Now we're constricting the vessels to increase the flow to the heart. Are we decreasing the actual blood flow to the brain? So let's look at epinephrine in the treatment of cardiac arrest. So the time to administration of epi and an outcome after in-hospital cardiac arrest. Maybe there is something else that's out there. So this study evaluated the use of epi in non-shockable rhythms and survival, which was very interesting. So this study said, we're going to use non-shockable cardiac arrest in hospital. And earlier administration of epinephrine is associated with a higher probability of return of spontaneous circulation and neurologically intact survival. Well, if you think about it, if we start looking at this, most of the time we are not getting epi on board in the pre-hospital setting until 5 to 12 minutes after the 911 call gets placed. So we're already way behind with administering that epinephrine, and something else is potentially happening. If we could get the epi on board early, and lengthen the dose and the time, the time that we're dosing these patients, could we change the outcome? So the results, there was a stepwise decrease in survival with increasing interval of time to epinephrine. So for 1 to 3 minutes, it was better than if it took longer than 9 minutes. A similar stepwise effect was observed across all outcome variables. There was something else interesting to note here, something was called pseudo-PEA. So pseudo-PEA is essentially a severe shock state and is distinctly different from true electromechanical dissociation. So with pseudo-PEA, you have movement and potential pumping and some flow, but it may not produce a pulsatile flow. So this could be detected in the absence of a palpable pulse by either placing an arterial line, which is really not feasible in the pre-hospital setting, but we may see high end-tidal CO2 readings in intubated patients or blind insertion airway device patients where we're monitoring that end-tidal despite we don't actually have a pulse. So when you see that increase in end-tidal, we expect there to be a pulse, but could there be underlying pseudo-PEA? So remember, PEA is a condition, not a rhythm. So if you're looking at the monitor and you're seeing sinus tach, sinus brady, sinus rhythm, or some other variation, but it's not a pulse, PEA is a condition, not a rhythm. And could it be pseudo-PEA with that increased end-tidal? So one of the things that they did note is in animal models, asynchronous CPR during pseudo-PEA is harmful. So that reined the mean interthoracic pressure due to chest compressions, and then that reduced that, cardiac feeling. So pseudo-PEA associated with better outcomes than true electromechanical dissociation. So in a small trial with end-tidal CO2 and echocardiography, were used to confirm pseudo-PEA. So these patients were missed from vasopressin and had CPR ceased for 15 seconds. 94% patients received return of spontaneous circulation and 50% had good neurologic outcomes. Looking at another one, rates of ROS were 70.4% in those with pseudo-EMD, 20% for those in EMD, 23.5% for those in asystole. So survival upon hospital discharge and after 180 days occurred only in patients that had pseudo-PEA or pseudo-EMD as noted. So epinephrine in the treatment of cardiac arrest. So when should we use epi and cardiac arrest? Because there's really a big difference between mostly dead and all dead. Mostly dead is still slightly alive. So as with everything else, timing may matter. In shockable rhythms, especially in refractory ventricular fibrillation, we may actually be making matters worse. So treatment of PEA or pseudo-EMD may be the better choice for epinephrine. So epi and cardiac arrest. Adrenaline has potentially beneficial effects in cardiac arrest through the constriction of arterioles mediated by the alpha adrenergic receptors. But that constriction increases aortic diastolic pressure during CPR, thereby augmenting coronary blood flow and increasing the chance for return of spontaneous circulation. So epi may be beneficial. But it may exacerbate the condition of suboptimal exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide associated with progressive hypoxemia and hypercarbia observed during asphyxial cardiac arrest. So it's theorized that unsuccessful outcomes after successful CPR are in part caused by impaired cerebral function caused by ischemic brain injury. I believe it would be appropriate to reevaluate epinephrine as a drug of first choice for cardiac resuscitation, especially under the particular condition of asphyxial cardiac arrest. If we can get the epi on board much sooner than that 9 to 12 minutes when EMS typically gets on scene, ALS, and move epi into another category, get it on board sooner by some means with first responders or someone else, much like we do with Narcan, perhaps we can shift the paradigm with epinephrine and not have bad neurologic outcomes and increase the rate of return of spontaneous circulation. So testing epinephrine for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, we must ponder whether additional treatments after they return to spontaneous circulation could improve functional recovery. Keep using epi while we look for stuff that improves neurologic outcome because further study is needed. So do not join the epi haters just yet, because every epi black flag article cites the same reference that epinephrine reduces cerebral perfusion during CPR. Well, how do they know that? For this reference, their method was cerebral cortical microcirculatory blood flow was measured with orthogonal polarization spectral imaging. What the heck is that? All right. So I did research and looked that up. That's measuring the flow at a right angle, looking at how well a cell is perfused. Not something that we typically do in the pre-hospital setting. But we do know that epinephrine reduces that potential cerebral perfusion during CPR. But why? What else happens when the heart stops? So epinephrine and cardiac arrest. So those alpha adrenergic stimulation causes platelet activation, which promotes thrombosis and impairs the microvascular blood flow. Well, that doesn't happen just in the cerebral cortex, but through other parts of the body. So when these platelets start bumping into each other and they start forming these microthrombi, we know that that further impairs what's going through that vessel. And our body mounts an immune response as a part of this process. Well, that cascading effect is the same thing that happens in trauma patients, which is why trauma patients, within the first 24 hours, get put on anticoagulant therapy, because their body received that injury, they've had an immune response. Now we don't want those clots. We want them to stay where they are to bandage and hold up the vessels and not allow leakage, but we don't want them to reduce the blood flow to promote that healing. So these blood vessels have some, you know, that microvascular injury that occurs. Well, that tissue damage, that vascular injury causes, you know, that the different factors to turn on and things start to become sticky. So now we've got those platelets, the red blood cells that forms that blood clot that then promotes that healing. But what really happens and what causes that? So the trajectory of the coagulation following out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. So we have the arrest, we have the time frame of the arrest, the patient becomes hypocoagulable. Well, then we have a return of spontaneous circulation. It dips down just a little bit. That is our optimal time to begin looking at fluids and optimizing perfusion, oxygenation. And then after about 120 minutes, all the way out to about 48, 72 hours, that's where we know that we start to have some coagulation issues. And we've got to make sure that these patients have optimized oxygenation, optimized circulation, and reduce the risk of coagulation. So what you're seeing here, the two lines, the red is out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and the other is out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with some therapeutic hypothermia, which was also mentioned in this study. So to reduce that inflammation and that other stuff. So we know if we twist our ankle, we know that if we do anything else, we're going to put ice on it. There's still some benefit for maintaining a certain temperature to keep the patient from becoming hyperthermic as that immune response happens. Because what happens is you have the glycocalyx in the vascular lumen. That glycocalyx looks like a real fine, hairy thing. So glyco means glycogen or protein that's actually there. And then calyx means husk-like. And what happens is that vascular lumen, because there's a decreased blood flow, there's increased immune response, those endothelial cells stand up. And when they stand up and those microthrombi start flowing through there, that decreases the blood flow, which causes some additional issues. So the question is this a new finding? You bet I reached back in my research library and found something that says it's been here all along. and experimental research into the resuscitation of dogs killed by anesthetics and asphyxia. Well, this was done and studied by Kreil in 1906. He said, this is what's happening. This is why asphyxial arrests are so bad. We also saw it with Fisk. But the limitations of the method soon appeared. Among them were the following. Antemortem clotting, overdistension of the heart, later failure of the heart, circulation, and respiration, and D, the apparently imperfect recovery of the brain. This seemed to confirm our previous conclusion that either vigorous or prolonged massage of the heart predisposed to antemortem clotting, and that direct massage of the heart favored clotting more than indirect massage by rhythmic pressure upon the intact thorax over the heart. We also observed one on a priori of grounds we supposed to be true, namely that a tendency to clotting was increased in a direct ratio with the lapse of time. When clotting occurred, resuscitation was practically always impossible. The heart would beat for a short time, but the beat would soon fade away. So what that means, in 1906, along with some other things, hands-only CPR, which we know came out in somewhere in the late 60s, early 70s, but it wasn't really pushed until like 2008, that we've got to get that blood moving sooner because it said, in a direct ratio with a lapse of time, clotting occurred. So we've got to get our telecommunicators on board. Is the patient talking? Is the patient moving? Is the patient breathing? No, 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 go to CPR. If the patient pushes him off the chest, we can stop and back up and move to another card. But if we get that flow moving, and with what we talked about with epinephrine earlier, the better, move it to some type of a BLS or first response administration, could we change the outcome? So what did we learn from 115 years ago? Animals, after death from chloroform, either ether or asphyxia, up to 5 minutes were uniformly and readily resuscitated. Well, that's what we were talking before, 4 to 6 minutes. The sooner the better. After 23 minutes in adult dogs and 35 minutes in puppies, complete return of the circulation was not accomplished. After death from chloroform and ether, animals were more readily resuscitated than after death from asphyxia. So it's better with those gases. We'll come back to that a little bit later, though. Resuscitation, if successful, occurred within 1 minute after administration of adrenaline in the majority of instances. Here again, 115 years ago, he said, the sooner we give the epi, the better we're going to be. It rarely occurred after an interval greater than 3 minutes. So getting that epi on board in that first 1 to 3 minutes has got to be part of the key. The greatest difficulty to be overcome was clotting. So there again, we've got to look at that clotting and what happens with the microvasculature in the brain. The probability of clotting increased in direct rational with a lapse of time after death. Cardiac trauma predisposed to clotting. The younger the animal, up to certain limits, the more readily it was resuscitated. So the probable success of resuscitation is greater in inverse relation to the lapse of time after death. So time is a key, which we already know, and we've got to make sure that we focus on that. A rapid rise in the arterial pressure is attained by arterial infusion with a therapeutic dose of adrenaline. And together with good artificial respiration and the avoidance of unnecessary cardiac trauma by massage. The longer we do CPR, the more we know damage is being done. But there's something else. If we're given slugs of epinephrine to patients every 3 to 5 minutes, we know the body is not designed to do three times the systemic pressures with giant slugs of epinephrine. So we need a more gradual, heads-up approach to optimizing blood flow. So, and the dead shall rise. So, in the study, consistent head-up cardiopulmonary resuscitation, hemodynamics, are observed across pig and human cadaver translation models. So maybe if we improve the blood flow, the blood drainage, we can fix that blood flow a little bit. So the study results, the perfusion pressures. So we know we've got to get the coronary perfusion pressure up. We know we've got to have cerebral perfusion pressure up to move it. But the problem is getting the blood to drain from the brain. So if we get the epi on board, we increase that coronary perfusion, we increase the cerebral perfusion, but we have not decreased the intracranial pressure. So now we've got to look at this. So heads up, heads down, which is better? Well, everything seems to point that heads up may be beneficial. Well, with that, it also shows that vital organ blood flow. Even with that, so we've got increase in heart blood flow, but now we've got an increase in brain blood flow. So we start looking at the human cadaver pressure tracing. So when we start looking at this, this is active compression, decompression, plus an impedance threshold device, ACD plus ITD. So we do that, and then we do it with heads up, and we start looking at the increased aortic pressures. When you start looking right here, when those were combined, we see that aortic pressure go up, we see right atrial pressure go up, we see when the head goes up, we see intracranial pressure go down. We see the cerebral perfusion pressure go up. So we're moving the blood, reducing the microthrombi that are potentially building up. So here's another one from another cadaver. So we see there again that intracranial pressure goes down as the head goes up, and the cerebral perfusion pressure tends to stay the same or go up slightly. So what's the mechanism? Well, raising that head drains venous blood from the brain, allows it to return back to central circulation. When you're laying flat, that typically doesn't happen. It lowers intracranial pressure because as ICP goes up, that cerebral perfusion pressure has to go down. It's one of the physics and physiology piece of that. So it lowers intracranial pressure. It enhances right to left heart circulation, kind of like setting up with CHF, and reduces concussion with every compression. But we can't just go in, pick their head up, put it on a pillow, expect it to be okay. But looking at all the studies that are out there with this, it says AICD, impedance threshold device with a head up, does increase it. So here, we'll break this one down just a little bit. So here we're looking at the intrathoracic pressure, aortic pressures. So here we have, you know, some spontaneous gasping that happens. We know the ICP goes up during that. EEG activity doesn't change. End-tidal CO2 begins to drop off. And then all of our perfusion pressures go down. So this is our body's last ditch effort, the agonal respirations. So we start standard BLS CPR 30 to 2. Here we start building cerebral perfusion pressure. We start building coronary perfusion pressure. We start looking at intracranial pressure because they're laying flat. We're moving blood to the brain, but it's not draining away very well. We're building up pressure in the heart. So we know that we're moving that blood flow. Then we add an ITD and start a Lucas device in that study. So in that study, that Lucas device is started, and now they've got active compression, decompression as a piece of that, and they slowly raise the head. So they do that over 2 minutes. As they raise the head over that 2 minutes, so it's not an abrupt change, you'll see that the intrathoracic pressure doesn't change. Here you'll see that aortic pressure continues to move up slightly. Right atrial pressure still increases. Intracranial pressure goes down. So now we're moving more blood through the brain because that cerebral perfusion pressure goes up. Does not negatively affect the coronary perfusion pressure, which we know we've got to build for hopefully the normal pacemaker to take over on its own. So what does the research show? Don't elevate the head too quickly. It's got to be done over 2 minutes. Got to prime the system before elevating the head and the heart. 2 minutes of priming with the impedance threshold device in place. This is not about the impedance threshold device. The research is still out on that. Maybe we can talk about it another time. There is an optimal elevation sequence and height after about 2 minutes of priming that elevate the head and thorax over 2 minutes. So the future of CPR may focus on neuroprotection. Well, you go, well, what about neuroprotection? So active compression, decompression CPR, it's already out there. Just mentioned it. There's some ongoing research. But making sure that we have that adequate compression and then pull up on that chest, no leaning on the chest, because we know that decreases coronary perfusion. We know it increases thoracic pressure, does not allow for appropriate ventricular filling. Heads up CPR. It's already out there. It's already being studied. And there's some ongoing research with that. There again, 2 minutes of priming, 2 minutes of raising, and then you may have the success. Sodium nitrile peroxide enhanced CPR. Post-ischemic conditioning after CPR, that's really cool. Some people out there may remember or have read before rotating tourniquets or rotating things like that for ischemic conditioning in strokes, STEMIs, and used to be done in congestive heart failure patients. It's another podcast maybe we can talk about. Membrane stabilizers. So maybe we can change that endothelial lining to hopefully keep that glycocalyx from becoming sticky, and then post ischemic condition with inhaled gases. But with all of that, and the dead shall rise again. This has been an epi tale. Thank you for joining us on the EMS Handoff on behalf of my co-host, David Blevins and Eric McCullough. We hope to see you at some time soon. We're going to start attending some conferences at some point in the near future. This has been the EMS Handoff, part of Handoff Consulting and Media. And never underestimate the value of your EMS Handoff.